All right, take your Bibles then, if you would, and find 1 Kings chapter 19. This is part 3 in the series on Elijah's life. We've entitled it, Elijah Receives His Death Warrant from Jezebel. Now, every time we read this text, and I trust that you never tire in reading it, I'm not repeating every sermon. I'm setting us up to learn principles from this passage that we can't get in just one reading or in a 30-minute or a 40-minute or a 50-minute sermon. We dare not do 60 minutes. But we're going to learn some things tonight about discouragement and the tool of discouragement that Satan uses against us. It is one of his strongest weapons against the believer. And when we are discouraged, we can make wrong assessments, wrong judgment calls, wrong decisions, and we can hurt ourselves when we are discouraged. And we see this in the prophet Elijah. And we have found him going from great faith of calling down fire from heaven and proving that Jehovah is the God and the only God. And he brought revival to the entire people on that mountain. And when the rain came, it was unbelievable. In all of that faith, he had no fear whatsoever. He was a fearless, bold, strong prophet. But when he gets to the city gates and he hears the prophecy of Jezebel, his faith turns to fear and he plunges into despair. So how can a man walk so close with God for 3.5 years to the point of God answering his prayers, performing miracles along the way, raising the dead, feeding him for 3.5 years in the greatest drought of Israel's history? How can someone who can walk with God by faith that much and that intense, Lee, how can all of a sudden he find himself 100 miles south in the desert, underneath a shrub, a juniper tree, so discouraged that he's asking God to take him? How can it be? Well, Elijah is a man of like passions, and we have those same passions. And there's none of us within earshot of the message tonight that doesn't suffer in some way a measure of discouragement. We find ourselves despondent. We wonder what God is doing. We would like to figure it out. And our heart becomes fearful of what could happen, maybe in our family, maybe with one of our children, maybe with our finances or with our nation or with the economy. We have all these things, our jobs, our ministries. We have all these things on our mind. And we are susceptible of great despair. And so when you and I are challenged by the trials of our life, those are opportunities for us to show that if I'm not careful, Satan will use the tool of discouragement to tear me up emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and physically, and cause me not to be able to function properly when I've got all the responsibility on me with my children, with my wife, with my spouse, or with my job. So these are principles that we can learn tonight. So we're going to read the text again for the third time. And this time I'm going to make emphasis on different words and what they mean to set our minds in a place to understand that if we're not careful, we can fall subject to discouragement, and it will rob us. It will sap the faith out of us. It will rob us from peace in our heart. So let's begin to read, and I'm going to point out why as we read about discouragement tonight. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain the prophets with the sword. Now watch Jezebel's reaction. So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them, speaking about the slain prophets, by tomorrow about this time. Now watch verse 3, and let me point out a word to you. And when he saw that, it didn't say when he heard that. A messenger came and told him what the queen, and she was the queen bee. She was the boss. What she wanted, she got. But it was more than hearing. Elijah saw. What did he see? He saw his blood being poured out on the ground. He saw that she is going to mete out her hate and anger for me. She's going to kill me. So it was more than hearing, it was seeing in his mind's eye. Discouragement starts in our minds, especially when we begin to fabricate what it could be like if things don't get better. Now, I'm not a psychologist, far from it, and you know that. But I have been around long enough to see that there is a psychology here about the study of the mind and what took him into a spiral downward into darkness and despair. It wasn't necessarily what he was hearing, the threats, it's that they were being lived out in his mind. Now keep that in your mind. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life. He believed her. Faith is diminishing at this point in his life. Yes, the man that called down fire and prayed down rain. And now he's running. And he ran, the Bible says, to Beersheba. That's 100 miles south. That's just not 100 miles south in the country. He left Israel. He is in another country. He's not even in Israel. He is now in Judah. Verse 3 declares it, which belongeth to Judah. Now watch this carefully. And left his servant there. I got a question for you. I'm going to put it in your mind so that you can start thinking. Who is the servant? Would not you agree that a servant is someone that probably knows the person in whom he is serving? Who could this be? Keep that in mind. Now watch it carefully as it develops in verse 4. But he himself went a day's journey, left him in Beersheba, went a day's journey in the wilderness. Now he's down in the wilderness of Zin, Z-I-N. He's down in the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. That's where he's at. And came and sat down under a juniper tree. Now, when you're walking 100 miles plus another day, you could walk 3 miles an hour. They can cover anywhere from 25 to 30 miles a day. So calculate that. He spent a lot of time. He already ran off the mount. to Jezreel. Now he's been on a 100-day walk. Days. We've yet to know that he's even eaten. All of this in a matter of days. Now watch what the verse says in verse 4. And he requested for himself that he might die. And said, notice this quote, the end of verse 4. It is enough. Have you ever gotten to that place? Hey, this is enough. I can't go any further. I don't know what to do. It is enough now. Oh, Lord, take away my life. For I am not better than my father. And I want to put this in your mind right now. That was a very arrogant statement. He was so discouraged. He had in his mind, this witch is going to kill me. And he ran out of the country as far as he could into the wilderness with his servant. And now, ashamed, leaving his servant in Beersheba underneath a juniper tree, asking for God to take his life. This all happened in a matter of a few days. You see, when the downward spiral of discouragement hits, it takes us into a deep hole. It's dark. And you can't see your way out. You don't even know how you got in there. It's difficult to even figure it out. You can't think straight. You're able to see only what's in your mind's eye that you fear now. We see no faith here. We see no praying. Think about that. A man of prayer who could call down fire and rain. It's not happening now. This tells us, folks, that discouragement is real. And it can come to the strongest of men and women, to the strongest Christian. No one is exempt from it. He was exhausted. So what happens? Look at verse 5. He fell asleep under that juniper tree. And then God began to work. And an angel, notice what it says, an angel touched him. Underscore the two words, touched him. And said unto him, arise and eat. Obviously, he was out of strength completely. And he took, and behold, there was a cake baked on the coals, and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink. He was so worn out. The angel of the Lord, God, is now on the scene. Now watch this. Though Elijah was so discouraged, though he was in the black hole of despair, he was still God's prophet. He was at the lowest ebb of his life. And this man, we read in the chapter before, had the hand of God upon him, even in his sin of discouragement and selfishness and pride. God's hand was still on him. Aren't you glad he will never leave us nor forsake us? And in the darkest day of his life, an angel came and prepared his food. This is not the first time. This is the third time he has been miraculously fed by the hand of God. You see, when you give your life to him, and his promise is, I'll never leave thee nor forsake thee. You're his child. And God will find a way to bring you out of your black hole. He will find a way to lift you up. He will not make it so hard there will not be a way of escape. It's wonderful to know. Now you see, we're reading this text for the third time in a completely different vein, aren't we? As we see a very discouraged man. And when he got through, he was so worn out. Look at the end of verse 6. And laid him down again. Now watch the second time. Now we identify the angel in this verse. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him. God's hand was upon the discouraged prophet, who thought life was not worth living any longer, who really believed in his mind's eye that his blood would be shed, and he feared death, and he feared dying by the hand of Jezebel, another mark of his pride. And yet God continued to touch him. Aren't you glad God touches us when we act so stupid? Aren't you glad he still loves us when we do dumb, stupid things? Aren't you glad he still cares for us and he knows how to get us out of the predicament we're in? And yet we doubt him so much. And we wonder how in the world this is ever going to work out. And the angel of the Lord, and we'll talk about that in just a moment if I can get that far. And the angel of the Lord said, "Arise and eat." He must have been a Baptist. "Because the journey is too great for thee." Now look at the last verse of our text. "And he arose and did eat and drink. And went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights." Well, here's a man who thought he was better dead, who was fed by the hand of God. He couldn't help but remember that God kept the cruse of oil going, that the meal just kept coming out of the barrel. He couldn't help but remember how those ravens would bring him flesh to eat by the brook. And sometimes in our lowest days, we need to reflect on the goodness of God in our life and not have self-pity and feel full of our own self so much that we focus just on us. And he ended up in Horeb, the Mount of God. Now let me explain to you where Horeb is. He was in the wilderness of Zin. Mount Horeb is the same as Mount Sinai. It's in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. It is where Moses went upon the mount and got the law. Now I want you to listen to me. I calculated the miles. Let me give them to you. Mount Sinai was over 625 miles from Beersheba. That's over 725 miles from Jezreel, where Jezebel was, and he was told by the messenger Jezebel was going to kill him. That's over 750 miles from Mount Carmel. And he did not have a car or a moped. He didn't even have a fast camel. He walked at all. Where would we be if we physically had to go through that? How well would we do? No wonder, and this is the first part that I mentioned last week, no wonder Elijah had displeasure in his life. He was persecuted by the king and by the queen, and by the false prophets of Baal. And we discussed that. We now look at the last two truths, if we have time. And I want to specifically show you two things, his despair and his determination. We're going to see good come out of this. It's going to get better. God has still has his hand on the prophet. He's not finished with him. The prophet is discouraged. He wonders why and how long. So now we can come to the proposition. Great victory on Mount Carmel. Just a few days later, he's in the wilderness on top of a dry mountain. Having gotten there by the hand of God. And here's my proposition to us tonight. Discouragement is the greatest weapon against God's people. It is Satan's master tool. It's the one he often reaches in his dirty, filthy toolbox and uses first on us as believers. We must learn how to deal with it. If we do not learn how to deal with despair and discouragement in our lives, we will live in despondency and in that black hole far more than we will live in the light. And God has called us to walk in light, not in darkness. He does not want us there. And we choose to put ourselves there. These steps downward were taken by a prophet who lost his faith. He lost what he had. It turned into fear. Please don't say, well, you know, nothing like that will ever happen in my life. Please don't say that. Those can become haunting words. They can become words that you wish you would have never uttered. Because you don't know your next trial. Well, you know, I've been through some bad stuff. Perhaps that's some of the best bad stuff you'll ever see. You're around the corner for some really bad stuff. How are you going to deal with it? You're going to let it put you in a spiral? We must learn how to deal with discouragement. Because if not, it will overtake the best of Christians. The strongest. We see this. We do not have to be a theologue to see this. This is easy. The siege of despair has not only visited the life of Elijah, but it visited Jonah, Peter, the Apostle John. When John was locked up in prison, have you ever read in Matthew 11 the message that he sent to Jesus? You and I would not have the audacity to say these words. I'm talking about John, the beloved disciple that rested on the bosom of Jesus Christ. I'm talking about a disciple that was as close to him as any disciple. Jesus put him in charge of his mother on the cross when he was dying. That's how close they were. But when he was in prison, arrested for preaching the gospel and only doing right with his life, here is the message that he sent to Jesus, and I quote from Matthew 11:3. Art thou he that should come, or do we look for another? Wow. You think he was discouraged in prison? I'd say so. He was in more than just a dungeon in the Middle East. He was in a dark hole worse than that dungeon, emotionally and spiritually and mentally. So don't think that you're exempt from the siege of despair. None of us are. Great men of God who accomplished more in a short time in their life than I would ever do in my lifetime of ministry, suffered with discouragement. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, was no stranger to emotional experiences. Now, they are Armenian, and so they have a view of doctrine that we do not share. But John Wesley was a godly man, and he was converted at the Aldergate Street Moravian Church there in England. Dolly and I have been to his home. And later, he broke with that church for doctrinal reasons and started with what we know the Methodist movement today. A historian, W.L. Wilkerson, wrote a biography about John Wesley. And I want to quote from that biography. And I want you to listen. Here's a godly man. Now, if you're sitting there saying, well, you know, I'm a Baptist. Well, you'll probably find out that some of your doctrine was messed up too when you get to heaven. Please, don't do that. We have history we can learn from. You don't have everything just right. Are you with me? Yeah. If you got it all right, would you stand and come up here and I'll let you take the podium? We can't do that. None of us can. Listen to what he says. Wilkerson said this: Wesley's new life in Christ began in his glorious experience at the Aldergate Street Church. Yet within a year of those glowing feelings, we find that he suffered a sad relapse into darkness and doubt and wrote in his diary, and I'm quoting John Wesley, he wrote, "I am not a Christian." That's how low he got. Doubting his relationship with Jesus Christ. I want to tell you something. Now listen, discouragement is real. It will cause you to think funny things about yourself, about God, and about others. So when we look at the life of Elijah, we see a man who has lost hope in this text. He's given up. He's left the country in which he served, not the city. He didn't get out of Dodge. He got out of Israel. And he wanted to die. His despair was unbelievable. It brought great pessimism into his life. He became a pessimist. He wasn't that way, but that's what discouragement will do. And that's the second thing I want us to see tonight, and that is Elijah's despair. He was overtaken by this discouragement. Now, what caused it? Let me give you a few things. Oh, I don't have the screen back there, so I have to rely upon this clock, and I don't look down here very much. I wonder if I can trust it sometimes. Number one, physical fatigue. This man got tired. He was a worker that didn't quit. And it finally caught up with him. His body was completely spent. He ate and slept and ate and slept. He was worn out. And when we are physically spent, that's when the devil sows the seeds of discouragement in our mind. And we begin to doubt. Doubt God, doubt our relationship, doubt love that our family has for us. We begin to doubt those that we have confidence in. They really don't have our best interest. We fabricate all these stories. We get all these things going in our minds. It's sad when you get spent physically. And now, weakened body, having worked long hours and days of walking and running, some of it, he began running from her. You see, it's hard to stay upbeat and positive when you're whipped down like that physically. A spiritual man, think with me if you would. A spiritual man's habit is to ignore the physical as the cause of becoming melancholy in mind, overwhelmed with discouragement. While you turn that coin over and you do not look at the spiritual man, but look at the worldly man. And what does the worldly man do? He ignores the spiritual as causes of his melancholy. Both are wrong. And if we can't admit that, we're going to have trouble in our life. You're going to need some mental help. Not just spiritual help. You're going to need some mental health come into your life. And God knows in this society that we live in, mental health is based on secular humanism. And it's not going to give you all that you need. In Spurgeon's book, Lectures to My Students, he said this: to sit long in one posture, poring over a book or driving a quill, is in itself taxing. What he was saying is, preachers, be careful about sitting at your desk. We don't drive a quill. What do? We use a computer. But the idea is the same. But you add to this a badly ventilated chamber, a tired body, and a heart burdened with many cares of the people in your congregation, and we have all the elements for preparing a seething cauldron for despair, end quote. Now, Spurgeon struggled with that himself. I don't know if you know about his life and death, but he died of gout. They knew very little about gout in 1892 when he died, and he was only 58 years old when he died. Physical exhaustion is one of the greatest opportunities that Satan has to whip us down like a dog. Secondly, is depleted emotions. When you get physically tired, and as your strength goes, so does your thinking ability. It affects you. It depletes your emotions. The events in Elijah's life that day would have worn out the strongest man in the world. But he went on in the strength of the Lord. I don't want us to criticize Elijah for expending his motions on Mount Carmel. It was needed. I mean, that man, he was hot as a firecracker as he mocked and made fun of the prophets of Baal because they couldn't call down fire from their gods. We don't fault him for his stand. But wise is the believer who evaluates what he or she allows to drain him or her emotionally. So we cannot be controlled by our vacillating emotions. They change with the wind and with circumstances. And facts and faith has nothing to do with it. And that's why we find him living in fear. Then there's misplaced vision. Thirdly, Elijah was looking in the wrong direction and at the wrong thing. He saw in his mind's eye his blood being shed in Israel, and he didn't want to die. And he ran from it. And when he ran, he not only saw the wrong things and heard the wrong things, but he really ran the wrong way. And then there's the measure of personal pride. You see, a secular counselor won't tell you these things because they don't know them. They don't know the Bible. They don't know the patterns of a man who has lost hope. They've already figured it out. Sigmund Freud has told them that if you're the third born, you're destined to this if you're the second born. Don't you remember Psych 101? I wanted to gag every time I went in the building. And his personal pride got in his way. And it comes in more ways than just boasting and haughtiness and overconfidence. It comes when we're in despair, folks. Listen to me. It comes when we're in the spiral downward. And it's just as evil and just as wrong. Pride doesn't have to be arrogance. Pride. And he fell prey to his own pride when he uttered these words, "It is enough now, O Lord. For I am not better than my fathers." And when we can recognize the causes. These are the causes of his depression. Next week, Lord willing, I want to look at the conduct of these causes. I want us to figure this out, because you will not have a Mount Carmel experience, and neither will I. And we'll not have some witch tell us that I'm going to kill you. We won't have it like that, but I want to tell you something. You have things going on in your mind and in your heart and in your life and with your kids and with your grandkids and with your marriage, with your finances and with your health and your kids. You have all these things going on in your mind. You're driving down the road and your mind is so busy, you run a stop sign, not even realize it. Now, the conduct that the causes will bring out in us is quite earth-shattering. And when we deal with them next week, and Lord willing, we will, I pray it will help us. So tonight, in closing, would you bow your head with me? I want to do something I've never done before. I've told the truth to you tonight, that every one of us, and I'm including myself in this, every one of us faces despair in some way. Disappointment, discouragement. We become numb in our life. We can't function. We want to go to the bedroom and turn all the lights off and curl up in bed. We don't want to have to think. We don't want to have to hear what's wrong with our children and what's wrong with work. And we just soon shut out all of life and try to have a quiet, dark moment. That is when the door of your heart is open to the devil and his tool of discouragement. Now, with our heads bowed and our eyes closed, I would like for you to say and mean it from your heart, "Dear God, I do face despair in my life. And I don't want it to control me. I don't want to get physically exhausted. I don't want to deplete my emotions. I don't want to have a misplaced vision. I don't want my pride to take over. God, please help me in my despair. I don't want to lose hope. I don't want fear to take over my faith. Perfect love casteth out fear." As the instrumentalist comes, and you think about that just for a moment, ask God for help tonight. No one in here is above it. Ask him.